early 1960s marked a dramatic change in how the people of Perth sought their personal safety. Although they did not yet know that a serial killer had been at work since 1959. No one did, not even investigators. There was no denying that Eric Edgar Cook was dealt a rough hand. Born in 1931 in the Perth suburb of Victoria Park, Australia, like much of the world, was struggling in the Great Depression, marked by high levels of unemployment, poverty, and loss of identity. The dice were loaded for Cook, and his hardships will worsen. His parents were given no other option than to get married when his mother, Christine, became pregnant with Eric. The young couple were not ready for parenthood, particularly Cook's alcohol. And I will go Eric and Cook. I apologise for that. But speaking of his family, it might get a bit tricky. So I will call him Eric or Cook, just depending on what the hell I feel like at the time. So the young couple were not ready for parenthood, particularly his alcoholic teenage father, whose name was Vivian Thomas. There was little access to contraception in 1931, and certainly nothing in the way of methods to detect fetal abnormalities. His parents had found themselves doomed to be together and struggle even harder now with parenthood around the corner. So things would have been different. I was going to say they may have been different, but who am I kidding? Things would have been different if he were born strong and healthy. But baby Eric Edgar Cook was born with a hare lip and cleft palate. For his father, this was breaking point. He saw the baby as a deformed creature and an embarrassment. He quickly rejected his newborn son. His father had a violent temper, especially when he was drinking, and Eric was the target of many of these beatings, particularly when he tried to defend his mother. He would go on to have two surgeries on his cleft palate and hair lip, one at 3 months and the other at 3 years old, but he would be left with clear facial scars and a persistent mumble in his speech. When he began school, this made him a target for ridicule and rejection, and that was precisely what he was getting at home. Being an outcast was something that he could not escape. Eric would have two sisters born after him, and he described himself as the freak of the family. He was hospitalised pretty frequently, actually, for head injuries during his youth. So these were either from the beatings he would get from his father, or that he was so accident prone. He spent time in the foster care system and apparently some time in an orphanage, and this was for his own safety. While he was at home with his aggressive father, he would hide in the crawl space between the house to get away or roam the neighbourhood streets. So these early years put him firm on the path to becoming a withdrawn, ashamed, and unstable young adult. He left school at 14 and began a series of semi-skilled jobs, and the wages that he did earn, he would give to his mother, who was struggling on the income she made by cooking and cleaning. He would then commit robberies so that he had some money for himself. Who am I kidding? He enjoyed it as well. Robberies and going into people's houses without them there made him feel powerful. He suffered several injuries while working. Between his childhood and even these injuries he gets at these jobs, one of them was second degree burns to his face. So this was caused by some sort of accident involving steam, while he was working as a hammer boy for a blacksmith. At 14, Cook joined the Scarborough Junior Surf Lifesaving Club. He was eager to impress the other members, and that he thought would give him a chance of being admired and accepted. He stole a watch and had it engraved so that it resembled a medal. The inscription read, "To Cookie, from the boys, from the SJSLC." The theft did not go unnoticed though, and Cook was then blamed for taking other items that had gone missing from lockers, and he was kicked out of the club. By the age of 18, he was committing break and enters, arson, stealing women's clothing and peeping into windows, but I'm sure there was plenty more than that. He was given a prison sentence for torching a church after they had rejected him as a choir member. He was paroled early though, in an effort to protect Cook from being corrupted by hardened criminals in prison. After he got paroled, he did show some efforts to get his life together, and a Methodist minister, Reverend George Jenkins, offered to rehabilitate him. So Eric was a quick fan of Bible study, and it was through the Methodist Church in Nedlands, so that's an affluent suburb of Perth for those who don't know, that Eric would get an idea of how the wealthy and educated lived. Or at least where the wealthy and educated lived. So he would target these areas during his crime spree years later, or even during that time. So at this, he would have been 21-ish, so I'm sure he was committing crimes at that point. This is a brief side note. While I explain for those who aren't familiar with the layout of Perth, so the suburbs that Cook would hit during his years-long crime spree read like an honour roll of Perth real estate, I'm telling you. So many of them are on the Swan River or by the beach. Nedlands is in the neighbouring suburb of the University of Western Australia. I hope I'm getting my point across. They're affluent. The time he spent with Reverend Jenkins, though, was just a brief reprieve from his hardships. So an important event would happen that would reaffirm to Cook that he could not catch a break. So at 21, he had set his sights on joining the Permanent Military Forces, which is the equivalent to the modern Army Reserve. He was successful. He enjoyed the sense of belonging and the structure it offered, and he performed well at weapons training. But he was to lose this accomplishment when it was discovered that he had criminal convictions for theft, break and entering, and arson. To make a bad situation worse, which to be frank seems to be just standard life for him, he was told that his speech impediment would have restricted him from rising in the ranks of the army anyhow. After this, when he was 22, he married Sally Laven. She was a 19-year-old waitress, and they were married at the Methodist Church in Cannington. Their first child, a son, was born 6 months later. What does that remind you of? They would go on to have a total of 7 kids. Being a husband and father did not calm him down though, far from it. He quickly began to be cruel and violent to Sally and cheat on her frequently. He would spend most weekends prowling, peeping into windows, breaking into homes, stealing cars. He had no trouble getting access into homes and vehicles. I would say that like he had the keys to the city, but he didn't need them. You know that adage that drives most people mad in true crime shows? We didn't even lock our doors back then. Well, that was Perth. And the other one, the expression, oh, this one really bothers me. I've never understood it. The expression, that sort of stuff doesn't happen here. Well, that was Perth too. And he changed that. Though I'm not sure how sensible it ever was to leave your keys like inside the ignition overnight. It's mental, isn't it? I don't care how handy it is in the morning. Just quickly though, sometimes Cook would return the car by morning as though nothing had ever happened. I will be right back. Eric would claim that he committed his first murder in January of 1959. The victim was 33-year-old Patricia Berkman, who went by the nickname Penina. She was stabbed with a scuba diving knife while she lay sleeping in her home. He would kill again before the year was out when he ferociously attacked Gillian Brewer, stabbing her with a pair of dressmaking scissors before mutilating her body. He had been watching through her window for months. So, in the hours following Australia Day in 1963, he would launch an attack on the western suburbs of Perth. And for those of you who aren't aware, Australia Day is celebrated on the 26th of January. He had hold of a .22 rifle that he had stolen the night earlier during a break and enter in a South Perth home. So at the time, 40-year-old Rowena Reeves was sitting in a car outside of the Cottesloe Civic Centre. She had been carrying on an affair with a married businessman, Nicholas August. The pair were having a drink when Nicholas noticed how someone was creeping in the darkness. This was Cook. He yelled at him to piss off and threw a beer bottle in his direction. This was no good. For many people who have analysed these events, reported on the events, have pointed to this as the instigator for Cook losing his shit. The firm act of rejection, that's pretty much what they put it down to. Soon after this, Rowena looked up to see Cook standing with the barrel of the gun against his eye, pointing it right at them. She instinctively shoved Nicholas's head away from the line of fire and the bullet went through her hand and grazed his neck. They were wounded, but not life-threatening. Cook was heading back to his stolen car when he climbed on the on top of a garage, which led to the balcony of a flat. The door was unlocked, so he entered and he shot 29-year-old Brian Weir in the head at point-blank range. Brian Weir lingered for 3 years with severe brain damage before dying in 1965. Cook then headed to Nedlands, where he crept onto the veranda of a boarding house. Science student John Sturkey was sleeping out there on the veranda. Cook shot him once in the head. John Sturkey was discovered by another boarder soon afterwards who had heard him groaning and she thought that he was having a bad dream. He died on the way to hospital. Cook was not done here. He simply walked to the next street from where he had just shot John Sturkey and pressed the doorbell of a home, chosen seemingly at random. And this was at an antisocial hour, so around 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. The door was answered by 55-year-old retired grocer George Walmsley. George Walmsley was shot in the head and died that morning. Police had nothing to go on. The only evidence they had were some spent shell casings. All they could do was urge people to lock themselves indoors. Having said that though, they did do a big dragnet, collecting the fingerprints of over 30,000 men across the city aged over 12. And they test fired over 60,000 rifles, so 22 rifles, but there were no hits. And Cook kept ravaging society and doing what he enjoyed doing, and this is a quote, hurting people. He was a free man for another 18 months. The break in the case was when a couple who were out walking through some bush found a stashed rifle hidden in the shrub. They called police, who conducted ballistic tests, and it was confirmed to be the same rifle used in a different murder. So, and after the Australia Day rampage, Cook was to kill three more women. And the gun, the rifle that they found in the bush, matched the rifle that was used when Cook had shot and killed 18-year-old Shirley MacLeod. So she was a student who had been babysitting when he broke into the home and shot her in the head. From there, police on the chance that the offender might come back to collect it, they took the rifle and replaced it with a replica, put it back in the same spot, but they had tied it to the bush using a thin cord. They lay in wait for days and nights. Then on the morning of September 1st, Cook did return for the rifle, where he was captured by police and arrested. So the immediate confessions. After his capture, the timeline is really, really doing a number on me. He didn't confess to the Australia Day shootings. So he did confess to countless burglaries, like it was mental. And the investigators would say how remarkable the detail was. Like he could recollect some incredible things, addresses, precise amounts of money that he had taken. And Cook told them how he would read the wedding announcements in the newspaper and target the homes of the bride, knowing that no one would be home. So, but police were wanting this confession for the Australia Day shootings, and they were able to coax this out of him. I'll tell you just how they did that. According to detectives, they took him out for lunch, where Cook was bought a chicken curry and rice. Detective Baker said, "Eric, you listen to me. You're going to hang for bloody certain. Now think of your wife and kids. Are you going to be dragged to the gallows like a mongrel dog, or are you going to go like a man?" And then they repeated the question, "Did you shoot George Walmsley and the others that night?" And Cook replied, "Yes, I'm the bloke you're looking for." A little logic fairy just whispered to me that I should firm up the details of the murders that occurred before and after the Australia Day shootings. I understand that a lot of detail, a lot of names and times and things would be flying about during this episode. So the earlier attacks were the murder of Patricia Berkman, who he stabbed with a scuba diving knife, and the stabbing death of Gillian Brewer, who was 22, and she was killed while she was the victim who he had been spying on for some time. The subsequent attacks were, he strangled a 24-year-old social worker, her name was Constance Madrill, and the hit and run of a 17-year-old, Rosemary Anderson, and Shirley McLeod, the 18-year-old student who he shot while she was babysitting. And as I alluded to during the introduction, police had not linked the crimes, and it's sort of understandable why they wouldn't. I think that most people would cut them a break because Cook's upbringing may have been like a factory for making violent offenders, but he buckles the trend big time with one big serial killer trait, which of course is having a modus operandi, the recognisable pattern in both, you know, their method and their choice of victim, or at least one of those, you know. But Cook's victims included men and women and varied in age from 18 to 55. And as for the methods that were used, so it's just mayhem, running down victims with a car, invariably a stolen one, stabbings, and with different weapons, knives, dressmaking scissors, and a hatchet. He used a tomahawk, and as I said, Constance Madrill was strangled. He used a lamp cord for that strangulation, as well as, of course, the shootings. Some of the crimes included sexual assault, some certainly didn't. Some included necrophilia and other violation of a corpse. So that is messed up. I don't have anything to say about that. Just thought I'd highlight it because it is something that people do recognise about his crimes. Cook was charged with the murder of Shirley McLeod, as this was the crime they had the evidence. You know, Cook was caught collecting the rifle, and the ballistic tests showed that this was the rifle that killed Shirley McLeod. So for those of you who may not watch Forensic Files day in, day out, I will just quickly explain ballistic tests. So a test is done using a test bullet fired from the same gun, and it is compared with the bullet that would have been removed from Shirley McLeod at autopsy. There are rifling marks, and these are distinctive. So they're lands and grooves that are created when the bullet fires down the barrel. So it is unique to each gun, and if they line up, if the lands and grooves line up, then bam, you've got a match for the use of the same gun. He was put on trial for another murder though. So he was put on trial for the murder of John Sturkey. And I'm clueless about this. I do not know what the thinking was behind that. But I can answer why he was only put on trial for one murder. And that's because one murder conviction was all that was needed for Cook to be sentenced to death. And this potential death sentence is what got Eric Edgar Cook thinking like, oh shit, I need to think of some way out. And he decided to plead insanity. And this was a method of escaping the death penalty. But he was given an examination, and it was concluded that he was not insane, get this, but rather he had a chronic long-standing resentment against society. I think we'd all be in danger if we were judged by having that. Cook made confessions to two other murders while on trial, which had already been solved by police, and for which two men had already been convicted and imprisoned. They were the 1959 hatchet attack and the stabbing of Gillian Brewer. So Daryl Beamish was convicted and he was already in prison. The second was the hit and run death of Rosemary Anderson, and her boyfriend John Button had been convicted. He was convicted of manslaughter in her death and he was in prison. So the confessions weren't accepted by the court. It was believed that it was a ploy by Cook to prolong the trial, and as the judge said, Cook was an unscrupulous liar. The trial was held at the Supreme Court of Western Australia, and it was an efficient one. It took only 3 days. He was convicted of willful murder, and on the 28th of November of 1963, he was sentenced to death. 323 days into his prison stay, Cook had his weight and height measured. 10 days after that, he would swear on the Holy Bible that he was indeed the man responsible for the deaths of Gillian Brewer and Rosemary Anderson. 10 minutes later, he would be swinging from the gallows of Fremantle Prison. His execution was carried out on the 26th of October in 1964. He was buried in a pauper's grave above the remains of Martha Rendell. Martha Rendell was convicted of murdering 3 of her stepchildren by swabbing their throats with hydrochloric acid. She was the only woman to be hanged in Western Australia, and her execution was carried out in 1909 at Fremantle Prison. Their combined grave is at plot 409 of Fremantle Cemetery. Yes, Fremantle Cemetery also goes by the name that joint where Bon Scott's ashes are interred. Please join me next time when I explore the wrongful conviction and subsequent exonerations of Daryl Beamish and John Button, the two young men who were sent to prison for the two murders that Cook confessed to and reaffirmed these confessions just before his execution. Please join me. It is quite fascinating. Thank you, though, for your patience with this one. It is one of my very first ones, and I appreciate that I've got a bit to learn yet. You can reach me by email, nightmaresomewhere@mail.com. All right, catch you later for now. Bye.